Ahoy, everyone, and welcome to Primecast Episode 26. Here's April's news and announcements. Adepticon has come and gone, and Privateer was there with a full slate of events, including Warcaster, Monsterpocalypse, and an Iron Gauntlet qualifier, as well as the Dragonfall Encore event, and the first of our 2024 Legendary event series, the Siege of Scarswall. The invaders made a great early showing in that siege of the mighty fortress wall that protects the borders between Kador and Ord, and it looked like Scarswall might not last the 4 days of Adepticon. But, in the end, the defenders rallied valiantly and held the attackers off, allowing only 3 Garlgast to slip through their defenses, all of which were tracked down, captured, and donated to the public zoo in Five Fingers, before they could carry out their destructive rampage across the Iron Kingdoms. The Defenders' victory will give their alliance an advantage in the next legendary event, coming this summer. Kruger, the Wrath of Blightergast, and Emperor Carver Maximum Esquire III and Warbore MMD-47 released this past month and are available now. The Shadowflame Shard Army Expansion, Orgoth Cursebound Cadre, and Scylla, the Abyssal Fury, will arrive in stores April 4th, and the pre-orders begin shipping from Privateer on the 3rd, so brace yourself as the Shadowflame prepare to go full force and the Orgoth bring on the doom. As if the Orgoth hadn't stacked the deck enough already, rules for the Garlgast monstrosity will appear in the War Machine app on Wednesday, April 3rd, and pre-orders will be open on this most not mini miniature to start shipping out the week of April 22nd. You can practically feel the earth shaking already. Subscribers can also check out Dragonfall, the home edition, in the app this week. Playtest and organized play manager Lauren Lauer has adapted the Dragonfall Legendary event to a scenario you can recreate at home. Giant dragon model? Optional. Also, going on behind the scenes, the Monsterpocalypse annual update cards are currently on press and should be available sometime later this month. We also have the latest Iron Kingdoms RPG expansion available in the online store. That's Into the Deep Wild, Monsternomicon, The Lost Pages, and Deep Wild Expeditions. And there's never been a better time to get into the IK RPG than now. All books ship free to domestic US customers, provided the only item in the order are books, thanks to our ability to take advantage of domestic media mail shipping rates. Now's your chance to stock that library up. Best thing about news and announcements? I get to say roll drums. Hello everyone, and welcome to Primecast. Joining me in the beginning of this episode is Matt Wilson himself, and we have a spicy topic to get into.
Yeah, we do. As you might have heard, there's been some unrest in Kador lately.
Just a little bit. Very much you've got some villain in my hero. You've got some hero in my villain mix-up.
Yeah. And among the Orgoth, there's been much rejoicing.
I know I have been.
So I thought it would be fun to talk about story a bit, since it's one of my favorite subjects to ramble on about. But specifically, we could talk about how the story and the game sort of intersect.
They do have a lot of overlap in War Machine.
They do. So, as you know, as everybody knows, we revealed this awesome new concept artwork for a new version of Orsus Zoctafir, the Butcher of Kardov. And the conversation on Facebook quickly went wild. And in a lot of ways, this is a pretty neat thing to see people respond to so emotionally over a story detail in, you know, what is really just a fantasy game world. I mean, it's never fun to see people posting, F you, Privateer, you suck. But as a writer, there's really nothing more fulfilling than knowing that you have created an emotional connection with your audience. And when you can get such a visceral reaction, such a polarizing reaction over just changing, you know, the status of a fictional character, it feels like a job well done. Now, not everyone may agree with that decision or appreciate it, but from a purely dramatic point of view, it's what we're working so hard to achieve.
As an Orgoth player, I love that Orsus is becoming part of the Sea Raiders. It's amazing. But as a longtime Kador player, I also mourn his departure. He is the original. Story-wise, it's a great turn of events, and we've seen it coming kind of in the faction for a long time when you look at, like, Orsus in Chains.
Yeah, this was set up quite a long time ago. Orsus in particular has been a favorite character for a long time. The Butcher of Kharkov was the very first War Machine miniature ever made over 20 years ago. I painted him dueling with Asphyxius on the original cover art of War Machine Prime. We've seen multiple incarnations. He's been the face of our anniversary special edition. He's appeared in a lot of the fiction, but he's always been a really, really tragic character. You know, when we first meet him, he's notorious for having killed a bunch of his own troops in this berserker rage. He's even responsible for the death of the father of one of his fellow warcasters, Sorcha Kratikov. Mm-hmm. This guy is a monster, right? Inarguably, he's a villain and he's entirely unsympathetic. But over two decades, we peeled back the layers of Orsis Zoktvir one at a time to discover his, you know, this awful past and the loss and the trauma that basically drove him mad. And then in the end, when he finally has this sort of moment of lucidity, the very empress that has been, you know, that he's been unwaveringly loyal to casts him off or defiant in order to do something that he objected to. And we've realized, you know, he's always just been a tool for Kaedor, you know? So then they chain him to a fell weapon and point him, you know, out in the direction of some enemy nation in exile. And it's this tragic end to one of the most tragic characters in the entire setting.
But it wasn't the end.
No, it wasn't, right? After wandering around in the post-apocalyptic wasteland following the Infernal Wars, right? He gets found. And now we get to see his redemption story, or rather his revenge story, right? Sit down, John Wick. I mean, would you rather see that or just have the character frozen in time or dead like a lot of others? You know, to me, this is an exciting arc and it follows exactly the path that was laid out for us, you know, a long time ago.
It's definitely going to be fun to see where it goes for him. But this is also not the first time we've seen characters change faction. There's been a lot of drama in the Iron Kingdoms lately.
No, we've told some pretty crazy stories around our pantheon of warcasters and warlocks. You know, I mean, Krix lost two major characters. First, when Gorshade returned to Ios and went to the Retribution and his redemption arc. And again, when Asphyxius joined the Convergence, which really was, you know, kind of more strong-armed into it or made an offer that he couldn't refuse. But, you know, and then we send him through a portal to the other side of the galaxy. So sorry, Krix.
And there's Deathjack and Karchev that fused after the Infernal War, but they didn't actually leave their own factions. They just became a dual faction model.
Right. Yeah. Same with Old Witch, right? When she opened the door for the Grimkin, you know, she was still part of Kaedor. And we had Sturgis who arrived DOA, right? So he landed in Krix as fast as he did Signar. We had Kane who went mercenary along with the remnants of the Black 13th. Are we missing anybody?
Well, Magnus and Carver just kind of jumped on everybody's faction. Nemo became a blimp.
Yeah, he did. Yeah. You know, I mean, at one point, back during Mark III, we were going to actually do a version of Magnus where he rejoined Signar like he did in the fiction.
Oh.
But we just never got to it. And then the story kept marching on and it felt like it kind of lost its relevance. But he almost crossed the line. And now he's, you know, crossed it for everybody.
Those are a lot of intense and wild character arcs, but at least they aren't dead, like Severius, Irusk, Stryker. I still can't believe Stryker's dead, like the poster boy.
So there was a time when we were afraid to kill any characters off, really, because we felt like we'd get a very negative reaction over it. You know, like, would people still want to play with a warcaster or a warlock that had died? So we sort of had this policy that we wouldn't do that. Or if we did, we would make sure there was, you know, something following right away. Like when we killed Denegra at the end of the Apotheosis storyline, her second incarnation was already there in the same book. So players never really had to experience that loss. They just saw her kind of, you know, evolve into something cooler and more powerful. By the time we were into the second edition, people were kind of calling us out on it, you know, for playing it too safe. So then we were like, okay, it's on, right? Let's see how far we can push it. And that was pretty liberating because it let us take the stories to much more dramatic places, you know, instead of just having characters knock each other around and then go their separate ways. We could tell stories that had bigger stakes and real consequences. And whether, you know, the characters died or got swept into another faction, we never changed the original models. So in terms of gameplay, nothing was ever taken away from anyone. But if they felt an emotional connection to a character, which is what we're always trying to achieve through the stories, then hopefully those moments feel more meaningful when they do happen.
Definitely. You know, Terminus and Balder died too. I remember that pretty early on. But then
It's
it's
a lot of
like
death.
definitely got more dramatic. And some would say Cador has taken more than their fair share of punishment than anybody.
I don't know if I agree with that, but I think if that's the case, it's because Cador has been such a cornerstone of the storyline since the beginning. You know, don't forget, for three editions, Cador was the primary villain in the story. It may not look as scary as Crix, but they did some atrocious things. So some of that is just how the stories were going to play out. But in Mark IV, Cador has become the underdog, right? We gave them some new heroes and we put them in a very tough spot with the Orgoth. And so we're getting to see Cador in a whole new light. I think anybody that thinks that we're punishing Cador isn't looking at the big picture. We have very much put Cador front and center in the conflict because we wanted to be able to explore them in a way that added dimension rather than just continuing with the same storyline of Cadoran conquest and ruthlessness, right? There was just no place else to go with that.
No, it's great to see a whole different side of the faction.
Yeah, and we knew that this change with Orsus was coming. So we really did try and soften the blow.
Yes, we did.
I mean, you want the Butcher back, or do you want a Warcaster riding a giant freaking grizzly bear?
Bear riding Warcaster, please.
I'm going to say it was a fair trade.
Definitely. I saw that artwork today. It was amazing. Just to refresh how much I love that character. And so the Butcher is back from his time in the Wasteland. You said he got the same axe he held in Riot Quest. Are you ever going to put the debate to rest? Is Riot Quest an alternate timeline or is it canon?
I don't like the word canon. You'll never hear me use it. Riot Quest is set in the Iron Kingdoms. It follows the storyline and it sits in this space between the Infernal Apocalypse and the Requiem timeline where we really haven't told any stories.
So it's canon.
I said I don't say canon, right? But since I designed Riot Quest originally, it was always just a way to imagine a more lighthearted and humorous way to approach post-apocalypse Iron Kingdoms. I mean, look, it's all story. It's all made up myth about a pantheon of characters that we've dreamed up. So you have to look at Riot Quest like a different form of that myth. Like we've been telling Greek tragedies for decades, and now we're going to insert a comedy in there, you know, and maybe some of those things line up, and maybe they didn't, right? Did the Butcher wander the wasteland chained to a Fel'ax and put on a few extra pounds during those lost years? Sure he did, you know. And if we told that story outside of Riot Quest, nobody would bat an eye at it, right? Did Eris go rogue after falling out with the Retribution? Absolutely, right? Did Gregor Boomhauer try to get rich looting all the stuff that was left behind after the claiming? I mean, what would you expect him to do? Anything else? Like, none of that sounds very far-fetched when you take it out of the context of the silly board game and the fun cartoony characters. Nothing that we did in Riot Quest couldn't have had a more serious counterpart in War Machine. We just decided to have some fun with the game. And for a short time, you know, during what was otherwise a low point in the history of the Iron Kingdoms, we approached it through a comedic lens, right? And it was a ton of fun. You have to be able to laugh at yourself, right?
So does that mean we're going to be seeing Chuck Dogwood 2 show up in Mark 4?
Look, mistakes were made. We got a little punchy from time to time, but who cares if something is canon? Let's just enjoy the ride. Maybe don't look in the rearview mirror too often.
What about Bumbles?
You're getting more Bear Riders in Kador, okay? Roll the drums.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back. In this segment, I am joined by some of the best privateers our catalog has to offer, and I am more than excited to introduce Doug, Travis, and John back on Primecast.
Hello, everybody.
Why?
Hello.
Overjoyed to have you all in here today because this is going to be good. Three amazing personalities to talk about Adepticon. You all got the opportunity to prepare for Adepticon, go to Adepticon, enjoy all the amazing festivities, and then bring it back here to me. So let's talk about what you had to do to get prepared for such an amazing event because this is the team that prepped.
Sure. Yeah, I always love going to Adepticon anyway. It's my favorite show with it being all miniature focused. But as far as prep goes, most of my prep was done a month or so, month and a half ahead of time because I needed to have models for the legendary events completed so that the studio could print them and paint them. I think Lauren actually did some of the painting on them because they looked really cool. So most of my prep work was done about 6 weeks before the show.
That's awesome. Which models were you working on prep for the show?
Well, we did Dragonfall again, so we know that Blightergast was there. And then for this year's legendary event, I had the Garlghast. Ooh. And the specialized terrain, the Soul Cairn, and I can't remember what the other one is called.
Ancient, I call it Monolith. The Total
Ancient Monolith. Thank you, Travis. See, Travis knows all the names. I don't know these. So yes, I had a bunch of stuff to get done for it, and it worked out just fine. Awesome. And I know the people after me had to do a little bit of rush work to get things printed and painted and shipped out, but overall, I was really happy with how it turned out.
And Travis, speaking of knowing all the names, you got to do a lot of prep work for this event too. Can you tell us how you got ready?
Yeah, really the process is Matt, John, myself sit down, figure out our event schedule. We work our way through what we want to run and get that onto the cart. People sign up for it, and then we get all of our terrain and stuff figured out. So we ended up figuring out scenarios. For that, we figure out the logistics. So like, for example, Dragonfall this year was different than the Warfare Weekend version of Dragonfall in that the shape of the tables was different. So we had to adapt at the event how that event runs. And then additionally, we have the logistics of figuring out our table space. This year's Adepticon was probably the biggest Adepticon yet with the same amount of table space as it had for the last couple of years. So it was constrained, to say the least. So we had to fight with ourselves on where our table space was and make sure we had the right positioning of everything to make it so that people could enjoy the events without like tripping over themselves. But then getting everything ready, day before showed up, we set up all of our tables, got to have the fun of figuring out how to make the Privateer Press terrain work for how we changed Steamroller 2024, and then set up all of our tables, and then got right into the events. So it's pretty easy from a logistics side. It's just making sure we have our crate of terrain properly set up and sent to the show.
That is awesome. And hey, having a different table size just means that it was its own unique event this time. We get a little added flair.
Absolutely. There's part of it where Lauren measured literally across all five tables with a dragon breath attack, and it was pretty ridiculous because normally it only hit a table or two in the previous setup. In this one, it was like a 8-foot, 10-foot spray attack across the entire table. So it was pretty ridiculous.
Woo! That is spicy. John, you are literally the man who preps for conventions. It's your job. So I'm sure a lot went into this for you.
I mean, a lot goes into any of the shows of this size. The primary thing when it comes down to Adepticon is making sure that not only is all the event stuff supported and packed, but also everything for the P3 Grandmaster, because we do that at Adepticon, so that kind of makes it a little bit special.
Well, it definitely seemed like it was special for a lot of the players there. I got to see some of the pictures, and I was just absolutely jealous. It looked like a great time.
And yeah, I've been to a show that has had like that much energy in a while. It felt really good. Feels like prior to the whole pandemic situation. It was super great.
That booth looks stacked too. All of those Krugers and War Boars. And I was just smiling from ear to ear.
And then they were gone first day. I had like a Kruger left on Friday.
Nice. There's just a little sign hanging said, should have got here on the first day.
We didn't even bother with a sign. People could
just
see
back it up.
And so we were taking orders for him at the booth. Nice. So ship them out to people.
That is awesome.
The other crazy thing was seeing people, because it is a Adepticon staple, because it is a miniature focused event, and they focus really heavily on that, the hobby aspect of having your models fully painted. Mm-hmm. We didn't require people to fully paint the exclusives they bought at the show. We want people to be able to play the stuff they bought at the show. But a number of folks, I think it was at least six over the course of the weekend, had fully painted Krugers, Carvers, and Warboars for the event. Some of them having it for the next day.
That's
So they came
amazing.
Thursday, painted it Thursday night, had it played for Friday.
Yeah, there
It
was
was
one
pretty
guy that did a
crazy.
pretty good like tabletop quality job in like 3 hours or something like
Right.
that. It was insane.
That's amazing. I love that dedication. I remember when Convergence first came out, there was like painting parties happening in the hotel rooms and stuff. That is the best feeling when you're like, I am so excited about this model. I cannot wait to put paint on it. I'm not waiting until I get home. I'm bringing my paints. I'm bringing my brushes. We're doing it right now.
The Buffalo crew did that. They literally line painted, I think, four of them together, like five or six of them together doing the same thing. Like, that's some of the neatness about exclusives at these events is seeing this hobby focus and this excitement to play the model. So it was really cool seeing painted versions of them already on the tables.
Speaking of painted versions already on the tables, there was what, five Garlgas?
Six
Six.
of them. Yeah.
Yep, six of
The
those
bright orange one,
that our
I
studio
forgot.
got ready
Oh,
for us, literally like hand delivered to me like the day before everything had to ship. It was pretty dope.
there's
That is.
actually seven with Doug's bright orange one. So Doug had painted his own, but then we had six of them for the battle at Scar's Wall. There was attempting to break through the walls, and the players got to bring a marshaled colossal, which is not normally like in the rule set, but we made it work for the narrative to break through, and then we had a photo of Doug's Gargass leading the pack, being the matron mother of the whole group.
That is amazing. So let's talk a little bit more about the Siege of Scar's Wall. Like, what was it? How did it work? And how did it go down?
So we had a giant wall table that the players were defending. They played 75 points on the defender side. And the attackers, which were effectively the Orgoth and their armies they've enslaved, were attacking. They were playing with 50 points. The reason they were playing with 50 points is because they got a Garghast. So they started with a Garghast in their army. There's three players on that. It was effectively 1v1s. The tables were split on the first day, but then narrative forces could change the rest of the events. On the rest of it, there was five tables, 10 players playing on the battle around Scar's Wall. So what those players were attempting to do is they were also split into attackers, defenders. The Orgoth army was attempting to take control of the Soul Cairns, and the defenders were attempting to destroy the ancient monoliths. As the defenders were destroying the monoliths and the Orgoth were stealing the power from the Soul Cairns, tokens went up to the main table, and as the main table spent those tokens, those powers went back down to the other tables. So there was a level of using these tokens to do things like rerolling attacks, buying narrative powers into the game, putting reinforcements back in so like you could bring a unit that was destroyed back into the game for spending these coins, and really having a mechanic that lets you do these things to play a game that's different than our normal game. What ended up happening is over the course of the 4 days, the Orgoth were attempting to destroy either the left or the right wall or the center gate and try to get a number of Garlgasts through the gate. Damage flowed over each day of the amount of damage the walls had taken. The Garlgasts were the only thing that could damage the walls, so it was very important for the defenders to focus and eliminate the Garlgasts from the table. And over the course of the 3 days, the two walls were defended heavily by the defenders, so they won a victory on that. But led by Mr. Akers himself, one of the local Orgoth players, is very heavily into Orgoth. He led the way by putting a massive amount of damage onto the gate the first day.
Nice.
And by the end of the fourth day, they managed to break the gate and get three Garlgasts through. Major victory would have been getting six through. They managed to just squeak three of them through at the end. The defenders put up a very valiant effort. So effectively, it was kind of like minor victories on both sides, minor defeats on both sides. The defenders of the wall managed to hold the wall, but the gate was broken down. So they'll have to do something to repair the gate. But the Orgoth weren't able to get through the wall in a sense that they were able to achieve total victory.
Awesome. What were some of the narrative powers people could buy?
So, for example, one of the narrative powers that people bought, I believe the Defenders at one point bought a table-wide fog of war, so it effectively reduced line of sight for an entire player. So, like the Orgoth couldn't shoot the wall as effectively or shoot the Defenders as effectively. There was a lot of craziness. There was people like deploying more and more like random stuff in there. People, like I remember people using like explosives or priming stuff as explosives to like do a last-ditch stand stuff they normally don't see in the game. They would give a description of what they tried to do, and then we'd estimate like, okay, how neat is this? How much of a coin cost is it to do? And then if it felt like within a realm of possibility, we allowed it. If it didn't and it was too game-breaking, we're like, okay, let's tone this back and figure this out. But there was a lot of weird things that people could do. Like at one point, the three tables were separate tables, and then someone paid enough coins to remove the barriers between the three tables. So all of a sudden, the
Oh.
defenders got to attack Gargoth they couldn't attack previously, and it was very interesting to see like that craziness happen that you normally don't see.
That is awesome. Doug, John, did either of you get to witness this?
I got to witness it a little bit. I was back and forth. And of course, the first thing, if I were the defenders, I would not let Akers have the front gate with his Urgoth because you knew that wasn't gonna go good, but that's the kind of person. I mean, he's one of those Orgoth warlords that you want out in front. So when I saw him there, I was like, oh, this is gonna be a good weekend for Orgoth.
Nice.
Yeah, so I got to see a fair amount here and there. The one thing I noticed was everybody that was playing was having a really good time.
As they should. It sounds like an amazing event. Like you got the whole new, what are they, gargantuans technically?
I think they're colossal still, but yes, you got to play a variant of the Gralgas rules. Obviously, some narrative changes, but you got to play a pretty close approximation to like what they might come out as.
Awesome. Well, that monstrosity colossal is terrifying to see on the table. The model looks amazing, and I'm super excited to hear what other people's takeaway was.
So I didn't get to see a whole lot. I got to escape the booth like here and there to just kind of check things out and see how it looked. And all I saw was basically hordes of models all over tables and then just really happy and animated faces. The cool part was while I was in the booth and people were coming by to either like enter the painting competition or pick up their models, that was all they were talking about. What was happening at the tables. So like they'd be coming in and talking about like the state of where the wall is at and either what they're going to tell their friends that they need to focus on tomorrow or like just how close they were able to keep this Gargas from taking out this piece and just that's all I was hearing and it was amazing.
That is awesome. Some of those battle stories that people walk away with from narrative events, you'll never get another experience like that. There, you could try to recreate something like this even in your home store, but man, like the amount of effort and care and thought and creative ideas that go into these narrative events, I cannot wait to see what we do next.
Well, and that's really the goal is that people are talking about it, right? They're sharing those stories and they have something personal that they got to take away from the event. And then when they get to see the fallout of those things start to appear in the lore of the game and, some of the variations on the models that we put out and stuff like that, it makes it that much more personal. And that's really, really fun to watch.
Absolutely. Those are the games people will talk about for years to come.
And all of our events this weekend, that weekend for the narratives were full. So, like, we had full tables, full participation. It was great to see everyone had a great time. Like John said, there was so many ecstatic faces about what happened and why it happened and how the defenders were going and how the attackers were going. And like that team building of, hey, let's defend the wall versus let's take down the wall and how players worked around that was fantastic. Like everyone was super excited about it. And with how Kruger Wrath of Blightergast came out this last year, I think people are really invested in seeing how this affects the narrative and how we you see what happens with Orgoth and the Iron Kingdoms in general.
Heck yeah. It's exciting that this also has a play out in the storyline. Like, we don't know what it is yet, but there's going to be rippling repercussions from their games.
I actually heard that if the attackers win, that we'll have Galgast riders next year.
What?
Wins in which respect? Like, major victory, minor victory? What do you think?
I don't know. I just want to make Galgast riders, war witches on Galgast.
That would be incredible. That'd be awesome. Well, that's a fun way to segue into our takeaways. Looking back, now that you've had the opportunity to go, see the event, talk to the players, play some games yourself, models on parade, do some hobby stuff, what are your takeaways from this weekend?
Sure. I mean, like I said earlier, Adepticon's my favorite show. So I know that we were as busy as you could possibly imagine. There was little time to get away from the booth. There was a lot of times that myself, John, and Charles were all at the booth and we were all engaged with people. And so there wasn't a whole lot of hopping back and forth. And by the end of the day, I know we were all so tired of interacting and doing our thing. I mean, we were tired in a good way. I know for me, I got zero games in after spending 3 months painting my army, because by the time the booth closed up and we went to dinner and got back, I'm like, you know what? I'm too tired. I got to crash. So it was tiring, but it was a great show, and seeing everybody again, especially after not seeing anyone over the winter, it felt good to get back out and see that excitement. And like I said, see a lot of people that I only get to see at shows.
That's the best. Getting to make connections with people that, like, literally come from all over just to hang out and talk War Machine.
Yeah, definitely.
John, you're up next.
So to kind of dovetail into what Doug was saying, the term that I kept using throughout the weekend when people were like, how are you holding up? I'd be like, tired but triumphant, because it was literally just a case of, like, every interaction was good. But after a certain point, that social battery starts to drain pretty fast, and you're like, must keep going. And yeah, it just didn't let down in the best possible way. So you'd get to that point, like Doug was saying, of like you'd put something in your belly and you'd get back to the hotel and you'd be like, I need to recharge so I can do this again tomorrow, because I want to have these interactions and I don't want to bring like this like half energy. So I'm going to recharge. And it paid off. It paid off in a big way, because even though I was stuck in the booth pretty much the whole time, the people that came in there to either get things or just chat or enter into the painting competition, those conversations are, and especially the ones at Adepticon surrounded by the hobby focus and just getting to play those special events, that's what I do this for. Like, it's the whole thing that like makes me get back to the office and be excited for the next one.
Heck yeah. I can feel your energy from here, man. Like, when you're charged up and ready to go, John just gets this like crackling enthusiasm that I love. Like, it's almost like psychotic glee, I guess you could, like the Butcher, maybe.
It's not almost like it. It's manic to some degree, of course.
But it is exciting nonetheless. And I feel the same way, whether it's looking at the pictures, talking to people, or just getting to hang out with you guys, that level of excitement just keeps going through the roof. So Travis, why don't you bring it in here at the end and tell us your takeaways from tableside, up front and close and personal from this event?
The big things that I had were people had a lot of fun. Our event sold out, which was fantastic. So a big lesson for folks for next year, sign up early. We're going to attempt to get more table space, which is always a goal, to have bigger and grander events. And I'm very much looking forward to that. The players all had a great time. I've been told numerous times that the show ran really smooth and we got to play literally everything we wanted to play. I don't think I saw anyone very disappointed by an outcome. I think there's a lot of chatter of, okay, how do we do this better? How do we improve for next time? Which I'm super excited about. I'm very much looking forward to people after Adepticon's Models on Parade being like, hey, I want to build a display table. I see all these giant display tables these other games have. Let's do this. And I'm very excited to see what folks are doing next year to really put us on the map for that. All weekend, there were so many people that stopped and stared at the wall because we had 18 feet of wall. We had a giant dragon. There were so many people stopping and like I wish I had a camera to take the expression when people are like, what is that? And that just seeing a giant, almost 4 foot dragon sitting on the table. I wish I could capture every moment of that because there is so much look of glee and excitement and happiness with that's really cool. Let's take a look at it. And people taking selfies with it and trying to show just how big this thing was without like having a good sense of scale for it. So people had a great time. I was very excited about it, very energetic from just seeing the number of people being happy playing the game. That's the big thing is just enjoy the game and have fun with it because that's what conventions are all about.
So, here at the end of this segment, we still have one pretty awesome event to talk about, and we have kind of touched around it a little bit with all the hobby content, but we had the P3 Grandmaster Painting Competition, and Doug, you were a judge. John, you were a judge?
Me, Doug, Lauren, and Charles, yeah.
Awesome. So, let's talk about that.
Yeah, so I took a lot of entries for the painting competition, and there were a lot of entries, number one, and number two, a lot of great entries that as we were looking over the models and judging the models, it was tough to make some choices. I know we have some insiders coming up, or they'll probably already post by the time this goes live, but it'll detail some of the winners and the artists involved with them. For me, it's always a challenge because 75% of the people entering maybe higher paint way better than I do. But I usually have a little bit of insight to throw at it. We had a good time judging it, and so it went well, and the winner was definitely fantastic.
Yeah, so the Grandmaster winner was a gentleman named Kwon Ho Kim, who literally came all the way from South Korea to enter into ours and a couple of the other painting competitions and get games in and stuff like that. And he brought us three models, and the one that ended up taking the trophy home was he did Dragos Dragatovich, and holy crap. The detail that not only did he bring out of the mini that was on it that he painted to just expert level, but the little nuances that he added were insane. So I definitely recommend people check out the insider that will be it's pretty much already live. So once people download this episode, they should go back and check that out if they haven't already, because words don't do it justice, and my camera can't do it justice. Seeing it in person is just whole nother level. And that's how it was with so many of the entries. It was a really tough call. There were numerous recognition for artistry beyond just the typical gold, silver, and bronze that we give out for people being at different levels, and we don't stick to a single category. It just has to be anything from our range, and it's just judged on its own merit. So if someone gives me a Sorsha bust, for example, it's going to be judged based on the paint job on that model, not anything else. So it can walk away with a gold, but it can also walk away with, for example, in the case of the one that Sean McAfee put up, it got both a gold and my recognition of artistry coin because it was just phenomenal. And the thing that I most like seeing each year is people return and they bring you something new that they've been working on either all year or who knows how long prior to this show, and you get to see the leveling up that they've done in the in between, so you can see where they are now versus where they are the last time they entered. And that's such a big part of our event, is getting feedback from the artists and fellow judges and getting that inspiration to just take your craft to the next level.
That is awesome. Getting to witness the evolution process of painters getting better, pushing themselves, trying new techniques, and going to Adepticon is a great place to learn new techniques, to take painting classes, to get better, to talk to other painters. And so they get to take away all of that experience and come back at it. And I'm over here thinking, man, this model took me a month to paint. Oh boy, that was a long time. And then you think about somebody spending a year or more on an individual model, and you're just like, wow, like 10,000 hours, here we go. That is incredible.
Yeah, it's amazing. And I lost count of how many people entered. All I know is that the case that we had was literally packed. So, and almost everyone I talked to is like, I'm coming back next year with blah, blah, blah. You know, like after I was giving them the feedback, and they're just already primed to go do their next entry. I'm going to need more cases, man.
That's awesome. Heck yeah. Like that's a good problem to have. I think that brings us to the end of the painting competition, which brings us to the end of the episode. Travis, did you have anything you wanted to say on the painting competition or the models?
I just got to see it from the peripheral, being in the events area. So like John and Doug, I was stopped at the upset problem, where I never really got to leave the events area. So I got to see a number of marvelous painted armies from the opposite side. And then I'm just looking through even the posts that we put up. And of the 43 entries, I recognize a number of the armies that people have played. So it's really neat to see from the opposite side of the people playing these armies and having and putting these models into the painting competition. So it was really cool. I think from a painting point of view, Adepticon is the convention for it. There are so many great ways to learn new painting, the hobby classes, and everything else about the painting competitions that we run is fantastic. I'm so glad that we're doing the P3 Grandmaster there. And I think if you have a hobby interest in mind, look us up for next year. Definitely attend and be able to put your best into the case. I think I look forward to seeing anyone's attempt and work towards their progress of growing as a painter.
Absolutely. Well, I think that does actually bring us to the end of the episode, and it has been a delight to have you all on to get to talk about Adepticon. I've already got the like tingly, excited sensation for the next one, so thank you for sharing that joy and enthusiasm. Do you have any parting shots, Doug?
No, I'm busy working on tricks right now, so there's deadlines to hit, and so far they're looking pretty cool, so I am excited to share that with everybody out there.
Ooh, yeah, Necrofactorium, here we come. How about you, John?
Now it's basically Gen Con is tomorrow, so I'll be all up in that for the foreseeable future.
Awesome. Travis?
I have one last one, and it's a story that Doug related to me, and I kind of want to bring up part of it. Is a person brought a model to the P3 painting contest, the Grandmaster contest, and was like, Doug, when's the butcher coming out? And Doug had to keep such a poker face because of Orsus the Betrayed literally getting spoiled and shown the next day after the con, but him having to keep such a poker face about said model, like not being there. And oh, it's so hard because we know some of the stuff that's coming and people's excitement for it. It's fun to have those kind of interactions. And I think that was one that stuck out to me of like this person wanting it so heavily. Hey, give me another butcher model. Give me another Orsus model. And then Doug not being able to say anything was hard. But I'm glad to hear it. And I'm glad that person's super excited about it now.
Heck yeah. That is gotta be the hardest thing about being on the inside is just everybody that asks the question that you're like, well, you see.
Right. And keeping that poker face of not being able to be like, oh, yeah, I know this thing's coming. Like it's got to keep it silent. But like knowing that model's coming out shortly, so cool. But I'm very excited for that player to see the model and then be able to do their next painting project. Because I think they said they won entered in the P3 Grandmaster next year. So we'll see what it looks like when it comes out. It'll be fantastic to see.
Heck yeah. Well, thank you all for being here with me on Primecast. It has been a great segment, and I look forward to having you all again next time. So, on three, we're all going to say roll drums, right? Right.
Right.
One, two, three.
Roll drums.
Drums.
Nailed it.